Okay. Yeah, I just want to say before I introduce our speaker that a lot of people have come together to make a commitment to all of you, to serve you. This commitment, when you're involved with the convention committee, especially one as large as our region, the Chesapeake Potomac region, it is truly about a commitment. You know, you start out about a year and a half prior to this day. We got some people who made that commitment, and I just want to personally thank this convention committee for coming together and giving us and serving us with an awesome convention this weekend. You've done a wonderful job. If you find anyone on the committee, just give them a hug. Just give them a hug, please. Yeah. We've got a treat for you today. A recovering addict that I've had the opportunity to kind of run into basically all over our fellowship. I've heard her message. I feel her message. And I want to introduce to you today Kathy H. from the Pittsburgh area.
Hi, everyone. I'm an addict named Kathy. Well, they like hooked me up back here behind this curtain, and I didn't get a chance to give my boyfriend a kiss. And I usually give him a kiss before I come up here because I don't know what I'm going to say, and I want to make sure he knows I love him in spite of whatever I say up here. So, I love you, baby. I want to thank the region and the Tri-County area for inviting me. We love this convention. Pittsburgh loves this convention. We come down here strong. We do. And it's no like hop, skip, and a jump, neither. It's 7 hours. So, and we like pile in vans and come down here and pour into hotel rooms because it just is a wonderful place to be for recovery for a weekend. And it's cheap, too. It's cheap. You know what I mean? It's like you could throw a bunch of newcomers in a van and roll down here and have the best time. And Wayne was back here talking to me, and he started talking stuff. Like, you know, this is the biggest convention on the East Coast, you know. It's bigger than Start to Live. That's our region convention. And I'm like, all right, but we got a regional office and you don't. So we're having fun back here behind the curtain. And Ursula came up to me and said to me, you know, I never met you, but I've heard a lot about you. And I said to her, damn, at one time that would really make me nervous. But today, you know what I mean? That don't make me nervous no more. It's like, you know, as a result of Narcotics Anonymous, it's my whole life's done a flip. And the things that used to, you know, when somebody would say, like, you know, my name or something, and aren't you so-and-so, I would, like, be like, why? I would not, like, you know, I always heard that, you know, addicts have a way where they, addicts don't communicate, we interrogate. You know, we don't, like, when somebody asks us a question, we don't answer it, we ask another question. You know, like, so, you know, ain't you so-and-so, why you want to know? So it was really nice to have somebody say, you know, I know you, like I heard about you, and you know what? And she was like, it's all good. And I'm like, yeah, it's all good. Recovery is just all good. And I'm talking about the struggles, and I'm talking about the storms, and I'm talking about, like, you know, the days that I was balled up in the fetal position, and the days that it was hard to breathe even because I was in so much pain, that they were still all good. They were all good. Because I got through them. And my ability to get through things now has built character in me. And my character is something that looks back at me in the mirror when I look at myself. And I'm able to look at the woman in this mirror today and be like, you're all right. You know what I mean? I'm finally okay with me. And that was my biggest, like, problem, was that I couldn't seem to live okay with me inside my own skin. And today, on most days, I'm like, you're all right, and you're doing pretty swell. For a dope fiend off the corner, you're doing pretty swell. Yeah. So I want to thank God for bringing me here. I want to thank God for mercy. That's what I really want to thank God for. Mercy. I mean, I truly appreciate grace, but daily, I feel mercy. And it's very humbling to feel how much mercy I've been given. And I'm really grateful for that today. I'm grateful for it enough that that's why I do things like this. And that's why I reach out to help people. And that's why I do sponsorship. And that's why I show up at my job. And that's why I go to school. And that's why I pay the bills. And that's why I'm who I am today, because of mercy. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure, you know, I've done this more than a minute, so I'm sure some of you have heard me share before. So, fasten your seatbelt. I want to start off by saying that, you know, if anybody's heard me share before, they know I usually start off by saying that I want to say, you know, if while I'm sharing, any moment that I'm sharing, if I start giving you my experiences and you feel the feelings that go with those experiences, then that's a moment that, like, my spirit's reaching out to try to get somebody to feel my pain. And when somebody is able to touch my spirit and our spirits meet, that this is what this program is about. This is what this program is all about. It's a healing of the spirit. And it's a healing through us being able to feel each other's pain and share each other's joy and not be so caught up in just ourselves. So if my spirit touches your spirit at any given moment, would you just take that moment to thank the God of your understanding for blessing us with the ability to be removed from self, from the bondage of self, for even just a moment, and actually feel what recovery is all about. Just like if we say, thanks, God, thanks. I always share about the steps because that's what I know recovery to be. When I came into Narcotics Anonymous, I want to say first, I hail from the Pittsburgh area in Narcotics Anonymous. My home group is Miracle on 46th Street. We meet Friday nights at 7 o'clock. We meet in a little building off the side of the church right next to the cemetery. Isn't that ironic? I definitely went from, the cemetery used to be a place where we always got high. I guess we knew where we were going. So that my home group's right next to the cemetery where it was actually like the scene of the crime. And each day that I get to go there and see that cemetery, you know, it's funny because I know Ted's here. Ted's in my home group. And he was standing there the other week talking about that he had walked through the cemetery and he started pointing on different little mounds where the people were that we used with. And he said, yeah, Larry's up here. And you know what I mean? Like, he just started naming. And I'm like, damn. Like, you know, the fatality of this disease, of people that were really, like, decent people, that really were, like, good-hearted people that got caught in the grip. So it's a good reminder every, you know, to go to my home group and see that cemetery and remember what the ends are. So when I share about the steps because that's what I wanted was a way out. I really believed in the lie and I thought I was caught in the grip and there was no way out. And I share a lot of analogies because it's funny. My little girl said, do you always like speaking analogies? And I was like, I said, I don't know, man. I don't know if my mother didn't read enough stories to me when I was little, but it works for me because I get to see it. And if I can see it, I can believe it. It was like what Kim was saying yesterday. If you have a dream and you believe it, you can achieve it. So I share about like the steps being like a house and being in the basement is where the first step took place for me. It took me probably 20 years to finally grasp the first step. And I'm talking about 20 years of like suffering and misery and torment that just kept getting worse. When you think it can't get no worse, it would get worse. When you thought for sure it was like the end, like I hit bottom. You know how we always say like, oh, they hit bottom. And I remember hearing a guy say that he hit bottom and this disease gave him a shovel and said, dig deeper. And it wasn't like we hit, I was like, I was always on the bottom. And I was just trying to dig my way out, but I'd never seen, the more I dug, the smaller the light got to the way out. And eventually, I dug so deep that I lost any vision of the light. And I'm talking about a state of being hopeless. That it's that's where the despair is, in being hopeless. And I stopped hoping because my experience was things just kept getting worse. I didn't know anything about progression. I knew nothing about this disease. I didn't know about obsession and compulsion. I was just trying, like, desperately to use successfully. There's got to be some kind of way to use and not have all these consequences. And I kept thinking to myself, there's some event that's going to take place in my life. Something outside of me is going to take place that's going to check me and get me back regrouped. Something like, if I get arrested. If I get arrested, that would be enough to give me a reality check to kind of get me regrouped. And I would get arrested and get arrested, and all I would get was arrest. I would never really ever change anything. I remember finally going to court. I came in here in 1986 originally, and that was a nudge from a judge. And that was because I had just gotten released from the penitentiary, and I was required, God bless you, and I was required to go to meetings. And I thought at one time that the penitentiary might help me stay clean, that if somebody would just sit me down for a minute, and I could get this withdrawal up off of me, and I could get this like paranoia up off me and get healthy again, that I would be okay. I really thought it was a tolerance problem. I just had a tolerance problem. And no matter what, if I remember thinking if I ever had to turn a trick, if I was ever faced with the reality, because that's really bad to have to turn tricks for drugs. So if I ever had to turn a trick, that would be enough of a reality check for me to say, all right, that's enough, I've done enough, I'm quitting. And I remember a boss saying to me one time at work that there was only a slight difference between me and him. He said, whenever using wasn't fun anymore, he stopped. And I thought, I didn't have that multiple choice question. Like, where was that on the form? Because I don't recall ever having a time in my life where using wasn't fun and the idea, well, let's just stop, came into mind. It was always like, go forward. It was always get more. There was never like this. I don't even remember the transition from using, having fun, and using becoming a job. It just seemed like a big, like when you fast forward a video, it just blurred and it was there. And there I was, and there was no way out. And I thought to myself, well, if something happens to my daughter, if they would take my daughter from me, that would be enough, because a mother to lose a child would have to be enough for somebody to stop using. That would be that jarring bolt of reality. That, what do we call it? Moment of clarity. Moment of clarity where I couldn't deny the truth anymore. And I would have to accept that I couldn't do this anymore. And I remember nobody coming to take my daughter. I remember me taking my daughter to my mother. Take my daughter to my mother and say, Ma, you have to take her because I'm afraid of what might happen to her, because I got people running up in and around, putting guns in my faces, in my face, and I don't know what they're going to do to her. I can't even protect me. I cannot protect her. You got to take her. Never even once did I think, well, stop. Why don't you just stop? That never entered my mind. It was like I was in till the bitter ends, and there was no way out. So in 1986, when I was introduced, I really didn't get this program at all. I picked out all the differences. I didn't see the similarities. I felt really sorry for a bunch of dope fiends that had lost their hustle and was going to church basements to congregate. I thought it was very pathetic. I find you to be quitters, losers. I can't believe you quit the game. I felt sorry for you. So as a result of that, along with some other slogans that I couldn't get with, if you ain't praying, you ain't staying, could not get with that, was raised with a very punishing God, and all I could think of was, because my experience was that any change resulted in only things getting worse, my experience was that if I did anything to improve my situation, I ended up jammed up even more. So I thought, oh no, they want me to be like these people on the corner, shave my head, play the tambourine, chant steps, hand out IPs, collect my, I can't see me being like that. I'd rather be the way I am than be something worse. So my fear of change was based on always seeing things happen to me that ended me up more jammed up because I lost hope. I had no hope. So when I came up in here finally in 1988, I came back. And I came back as a result of a ramrod coming through my door, me ending up in a hospital because the county jail would not even take me. No. I've been put out of a lot of places. A lot of really bad, like, you know, hole-in-the-wall bars. When the county jail wouldn't take me, there was my moment of clarity. When the matron said that she would not even search me because she would not even touch me because I oozed of infection, because I had bandages wrapped all over me from abscesses that were just draining, how sometimes I would even try to get, I would try to shoot dope and I would put the needle in and I would push and it would come out a different hole. You hear what I'm saying? I'm talking about the pain of using. I'm talking about the desperation. I'm talking about dying from the inside out. The outside was nothing like the inside. The outside was a prune and a step up. Like if she didn't want to touch the outside, didn't nobody want a glimpse of the inside? Because I hated myself. I couldn't even look in the mirror. When I would look at myself, you know, sometimes like when I'd be boosting or something, and I'd run past a store, and in the window I'd see a reflection of a something. Not even a someone. I remember my little girl sitting at the dinner table one time, and I used to ask them when they would come home from school, what'd you learn today? And my son would always tell me some, you know, like sort of academic, studious sort of thing. And my daughter would come off the hook with something. She turns to me the one day, she says, I learned what matter is. And I said, oh, that's nice. What is matter? She says, matter is anything that has weight and takes up space. And I thought, oh my God, I turned into matter. I was matter. I wasn't a person. I wasn't like a being. I was matter. And really, nothing mattered. Nothing was important anymore. And as a result of that, I remember, like, you know, The DEA breaks my door down, and they give me one of those, like, you made the big time. And for real, at that time, I actually thought I had. I was like, I'm federal. Excuse me. You know, yeah, I did time, federal. And for real, all it was a bunch of dope fiends getting high, running scripts, and they made a federal case out of it. Bottom line, just a bunch of dope fiends. Didn't nobody have no money. Everybody was represented by, like, you know, a defender. Nobody had a dime. And all I had was abscesses to show for it. So when I came in here back in 1988, the second step finally shines a little bit of light in that dark, dingy place. And I'm talking about getting hope. I'm talking about a drop of hope for a dope fiend is like a ray of light. I came into these rooms and I would sit in the back and I would keep my hands in my pockets. I was so ashamed of what I had done to myself. I remember people used to say to me, you're such a pretty girl. That wasn't there anymore. You know, you're such a smart girl. That was gone too. It took it all. The disease took it all. And it wanted every last bit of me. And I crawled into these rooms and I'd sit in the back and I couldn't even comb my hair because I was so sick I couldn't get my hands above my head to even comb my hair. And it was just an effort to try to keep my head up on my neck. And I was so ashamed and I'd sit in the back and I'd sit in the corner and I'd stay close to the door just in case I had to get out fast. And I knew I smelled. I couldn't stop the infection. I tried to keep it clean, but it smelled. It was like the disease was like easing and pouring out of me. And I knew that anybody else that saw me would like find me to be disgusting. And I could feel within myself disgust for me. And somehow I'd come into these rooms and people would still try to hug me. And nobody would say anything about how nasty I smelled or what I had done to myself. I remember going to a meeting one time and there was a woman sitting across the table from me. And I remember seeing her hands. And she put her hands out on the table she was sharing. She put her hands out on the table and I saw them. I saw the wounds. I saw the scars. I saw them healed. I saw that she had been where I had been. And I knew that she got out and that she finally was healing. And she really didn't have to say anything. She didn't have to say anything to me. You hear what I'm saying? I'm saying that all she had to do was show up. She just had to show up and be her. And she put her hands out, and I knew at that moment, in that moment, that this was going to work for me. There was no doubt in my mind. I knew it because I saw it. It was real to me. And I came to believe, and I felt hope. I remember trying to get out of a room one time because I would hate to be hugged. And the only reason I would hate getting hugged was because I was afraid that if somebody embraced me, that the pain would come out and I would start to cry. And I was still a dope fiend at heart. And you know, never let them see you sweating, don't you dare cry. And I didn't want anybody to hold me that, you know, that those tears would start to come because it'd be like a golf ball. It comes up out of the gut like a golf ball. You know what I mean? You feel it coming straight up and it gets stuck up in here. And I would try to swallow it back down. But this bad boy was coming and it wasn't stopping. This girl saw me in the corner. She made a big, I have this thing where I don't make eye contact with people. And I don't make it because once I engage, I know I have to talk. So I would make it a point to look at the floor. I would look at the floor and I would head for the door. That's like my MO. So this girl sees me and I don't know how she got me, but we made eye contact and I knew I was in trouble because she locked in on me. So I'm looking for the door trying to get out the door, and for some reason I sat in a different spot. I'm talking about a gone in my understanding. I'm talking about this wasn't in my order. I was out of order. And for some reason, she zoomed in on me, and I couldn't make it to the door before she caught me. And she come with the, you know, the arms out thing. Here she comes. She's coming. I can't get away. I'm stuck in the damn corner. And I know she's got me with the big smile. She's got the smile. Hi, you know what I mean? You know who I mean. Us. She's coming, and I can feel me starting to sweat even. I'm getting a nervous wreck. She grabs hold of me, and she hugs me, and she doesn't do the burp thing. You know the burp one? No, she doesn't burp me. She holds me. I'm talking about she puts her arms around me, and she holds me. Now I can't get her loose. So what else is there left to do? I really put my arms around her, and she does it. She says it in my ear, ever so softly, the words that will take an addict out of the gutter and lift them up on their feet. She says it to me real quiet, and she says, you know, you don't have to live like that anymore. And I'm telling you, I felt it. I didn't just hear it. I felt it. There was something that took place inside of me. My stomach flipped. You heard? I'm talking about, I tried several bags of dope, couldn't get that to happen no more. My stomach flipped. I got goosebumps, right? And there was a rush that came over me. It was a rush. And I was like, what did she just do to me? I thought, I'm gay. I couldn't imagine, what did she just do to me? Because I never felt this before. I don't remember ever, unless I was putting something in me. I don't remember, this was hope. I didn't know I was feeling hope. I felt alive. For a moment, I felt human in that moment. And there again, I came to believe. And I knew this was going to work for me. Something just inside me said, girl, this is going to work for you. You can do this. When I know I don't have to live like that anymore, that is such an awakening of a spirit. And comes the third step, and the third step is taking the steps up out of the... Follow the light. Follow the light. Stop living in the dark. And I start taking steps up out of the basement. I had no understanding of God. When I came into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, my mother is religious. And as my disease progressed, my mother is a denomination that lights candles. And so as my disease progressed, the candles got bigger. They get bigger. And as my disease progressed, my mother would try to get saints. My mother believes in these saints that do these interventions on people, right? And so she would send me different saints cards. Every time I'd go to jail, I'd have a different saint of some kind that would be, you know, she would be praying for them to help me. I think we started out with St. Francis, and, you know, there was some St. Anthony in there somewhere, and now I'm in the county jail. She sends me the hit card. She sent me the hit card. She sends me St. Luke, which is the patron saint of hopeless cases and lost causes. I said, Mom, what are you trying to do? Why would you send me this guy? Don't send me this guy. I don't want to hook up with this crew. And little did I know that in that moment, at that moment, the God of the understanding that she had was working for her even though I didn't have one. Because she hooked me up with the crew of hopeless cases and lost causes, and I ended up in Narcotics Anonymous. And I finally started to pick pieces of what people would share about God, and I would go to meetings. Thank you, Frankie. What a gentleman you are, Frankie. Thank you. Where's my boyfriend? I love you, hon. Okay. And I would go to meetings and I would bring the topic up. See, I was one of those people, like, even though I'm back in the day, my clean date's 12/7/88. I have 15 years, right? Oh, yeah, that reminds me. Oh, we have a celebration today. Beth is actually celebrating 5 years clean today. So I want to say happy anniversary to you. Happy anniversary to you. Happy anniversary. You're a miracle. Happy anniversary to you. And many more. So I would go to meetings and I would ask people if they could, like, tell me what the God of their understanding was about. See, I did come back in the day, like Kim would say, where they'd tell you to sit in the front, you know, shut up, you don't know nothing. If we want to know, where the cop will ask you. That's what they used to say. But there were a few other people that would say, this is a disease, you could talk to death. And I didn't shut up. And I've been talking ever since. Because I know you got to come clean to stay clean up in here. I know that. So I would go into meetings and I would, like, you know, raise my hand and I need somebody to share about the God of their understanding. And people would start sharing. And they would, I mean, people had some wild ideas. I had a guy tell me one time the God of his understanding had a flat forehead. I said, this guy's a lunatic. Right? But, you know, hey, whatever floats your boat in here, that's your choice. He said, the God of his understanding all day long gives him direction. All day long he says, Joe, turn right. Joe, get the fork in the road. Turn right, Joe. Joe turns left. God says, damn, he missed the message. So God had a flat forehead. But that was an understanding that worked for me because God never abandoned Joe. God always went to the next fork. And God would constantly be there. That's why his forehead was so flat. I was, like, cool with that. It wasn't a punishing God. It was a loving and caring God. It was one I could work with. And I pulled pieces of your God and his God and her God. And I put these pieces together that made something that was mine. Something that worked exclusively for me. There was a difference between religion and spirituality. It's hard to tell sometimes in the rooms anymore. But there's a difference. And I remember being told early on that, you know, religion was for people that prayed so they don't go to hell. And spirituality was for people that prayed so they didn't go back. But I know it today. That spirituality is just about believing in a relationship with a higher power. And whatever that relationship is and whatever that power is for your choice. That is powerful. That is freedom. For me not to define what you have to believe about a God of your understanding. So as a result, I started taking steps because I started believing in the things you were saying. God ain't going to give you more than you can handle. Take a step. God didn't bring you this far to let you down. Take a step. If God closes one door, he opens another. Take a step. God is good all the time. Take a step. If God is for you, who could be against you? Take a step. It was willingness I learned about. Willingness to step out. Step out on blind faith, even. As a result of the third step, I got faith. Because I learned to be willing to take a risk, to try new things. After I come to believe, I made the decision. And four, the door opens, we're on four, it's still dark. What does the third step say to me? It says all that's required is willingness to this step. All that's essential is that I open the door to a power greater than myself. My trouble with my fourth step, 16 months on my fourth step, right? Afraid to write because I'm coming out of a marriage that left me with twins that I had to support on my own, and afraid that I would like find so much pain in four that it would push me over the edge. These steps are not designed to create pain. These steps are designed exclusively to relieve pain. My struggle with my fourth step wasn't my fourth step. My struggle with my fourth step was my third step. I have found in my experience in the steps that it's not the step I'm on that's the problem. It's the step before. I didn't get the juice I needed from the one before to move ahead. You know what I'm talking about? I'm talking about walking up steps. I'm talking about every time I take a step up to the next step and I put my foot on that step, that the one before has to hold all my weight. And if that step does not hold my weight, I can't move up. So I have to have a solid faith, belief, before I can have the courage to move to four. What do we say? When the pain outweighs the pleasure, we will surely let go. So finally, I was raised in a decision that happened to me in four, where I remember I used to cry every night. He's using, sleeping in the bed. I'm sleeping with the enemy. I got two little babies in the crib that are premature. I got to go to work, never really worked a job ever. I got to get up and go to work and worry while I'm at work what he's going to take from the house while I'm working. And I'm laying in bed and I'm crying thinking, it wasn't supposed to work out this way. This wasn't the plan. I'm doing the right things. This isn't the way it's supposed to be. And I used to go down and I would sit on the steps in the basement and cry. I'd get away because I didn't want to wake him up, because you know you wake a dope ugly. And I would sit in the steps and I would rock on the steps in the basement and I would cry. I would say, like, God, I'm like doing right here and I'm trying really hard and I don't understand. I'm doing my part. Where's your part, God? When all of a sudden I stopped crying. And it hit me that the problem was exactly what I was doing. I was sitting on the steps. If you want relief, work a step. I'm talking about being in a state of recovery where I'm faced with feeling suicidal, homicidal, and desperate, just like active addiction. Thinking to myself, this is insane. Then make the decision and write the step. And I did my fourth step. And I remember getting exposed to things in my fourth step. I just wrote another one not that long ago. And I remember getting exposed to some things that says, like, it's going to, you know, help us sort out the contradiction and the confusion in our lives. You know that feeling of, why do I keep ending up in the same place? The players are changing, the situations are changing, but I keep ending up in that same funk over and over and over the loneliness, the despair, the desperation, the fear. Why do I keep ending up here? So I heard a guy say one time, yeah, sure, that the fourth step is like a roller coaster ride, but it's the only way to get off the merry-go-round. So what I found in my fourth step was that I was a very angry person. And the reason I was so angry was because throughout my life, when people didn't live up to my expectations, I got a resentment. And when I got a resentment, they had to pay. Somebody did something that hurt me, so then I have to return the hurt. Some demented sort of belief that if you hurt me, then I can give you back the hurt that you gave me, and then I will be free of the hurt. Like a child with a bone. My little grandson says that to me sometimes. When I won't let him do what he wants to do, he'll turn to me and he'll say, "Meemaw, you're mean. Take it back." And I think that I spent most of my life, I'm not just talking as a child, I'm talking about an adolescent, an adult, through active addiction. The more pain I find myself in, I was walking around like an open wound. So, because I'm holding these resentments and trying to make people pay, and check this out, not only are they going to pay, but they're going to pay until they look like they're in enough pain to equal the pain that I'm in. So if you don't look like you're getting hurt enough, I have to keep doing it. So if you cheat on me, then I have to cheat on you, and I have to cheat on you. And if you, like, you know what I mean, robbed me, then I have to do something to rob you. If you belittled me, then I have to belittle you. If you were inconsiderate of me, I'm going to be inconsiderate of you. I'll wait for my moment. I'm talking about living in the grip. Without the use of a drug, living in the grip, living in torment, living like a predator, like it reduced to the animal level. The fifth step finally opens up, the lights come on in the whole house. You get to the exact nature, because I'm afraid, I don't know, I am afraid of pain. Bottom line, I'm afraid of pain, and I'm afraid that I won't get through it. And I'm afraid that I'll get caught in that despair, that desperation. I'm afraid I'll get caught in the depression. I'm afraid it'll pull me down. I'm afraid it'll swallow me whole, and I won't get up, and I'll end up using or killing myself. That's what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid of being alone in my own pain. And I do many things to avoid that. And many of them do not work. And that's what happens in six. Now that the lights are on, this place is a mess. There's garbage everywhere. I'm talking about defects of character. The way I try to go about avoiding this kind of pain, or making them pay for the pain, or pretending like it doesn't really exist. Saying it doesn't hurt when it does. Breaking up out of a relationship saying, he wasn't shit anyways, and the sex wasn't nothing. Dying inside. Dying inside. You hear what I'm saying? Defects of character killing me. I didn't know they separated me from God. I didn't know a defect. Look. Character is based on practice and principle. Defect is like abandoning a mission. A character is based on living in good health and spirit. That's what a principle's for. A principle is to be practiced to help us to live in good health and spirit. If I defect from my character, then I abandon the mission to live in good health and spirit. So I have to disconnect from God. Guess who I partner up with then? It's the disease. Look, I'm a human being. I was designed to be dependent on a power. I alone don't have the power. Self-sufficiency's a lie. So I have to hook up with a power. power somewhere. It's either going to be a higher power or a lower power. But it's going to be a hookup. So that's really what I'm looking at in six. Who's your partner? Who you hooked up with? I always wanted a thorough partner. I always wanted somebody to always be there. You know what I mean? Would come to my aid, would give me like guidance, would do their part. I always wanted like a thorough partner. But why? I still like, you know what I mean, try an easy shortcut. Look, I started school and I switched my whole like, I was always into social work and I switched up into nursing, which is not my forte. And as a result, you know what I mean, I struggle with it sometimes. So what's my best thought when I struggle is to cheat. That's my best thinking. It's funny, my daughter says to me, she works as a nurse, my oldest daughter. And I'm not sure that I can like really do this nursing thing because I have felony convictions. So I just keep walking through doors as they open and trying just to like have faith. And my daughter says to me, well, don't panic. Like, if you can't be a nurse in a hospital, maybe they can let you get a job where you, like, you know, transport organs to different places. And I said to her, why the hell would somebody give me a job transplanting organs, you know, if they wouldn't let me in a hospital? Do you know how much of a black market there is for organs? And I can remember her looking back at me going, Ma, do you always think like that? And I said to her, yes! I'm telling you, I can walk into a meeting, I can see a puddle on the floor, and a slip and fall suit enters my mind. I don't summon these thoughts. You know what I mean? I don't like, oh, please, let me think demented, tragic things. I don't ask for this stuff. This stuff comes without my permission. Okay? It comes without my permission. It takes a program of spiritual principles to not let me act on that. That's what all our slogans are about. They're quick spiritual principles to get us out of a jackpot. Because there's only a maybe New York second between obsession and compulsion. When the thought comes, the action soon follows. Now, if I get the thought, I have a moment. There's just a quick moment there to not do it. And that moment is for a God of my understanding to intervene. It's for me to say, God, please help me. You hear what I'm saying? Every time one of them thoughts come, it's God, please help me. Because if I don't do that, I'm doomed to partner up with that. And sometimes I still fall short. So I put all the garbage in the bag and I ask God to remove it. And then comes seven. And in seven I say, wait, God, hold up. I think I threw away something I really need. And I become a garbage picker. I start sorting through garbage to see if I can clean up a defect so that I can make it just be maybe, just, you know, mistake maybe, just a little bit. Maybe I can clean it up and it'll like be a shorter, easier way. And so I notice still that, look, man, this disease is progressive. It's no joke. So now, when I like, you know, have somebody cause me harm, I notice that I don't like try to do to them what they did to me because I'm, you know, doing something with these defects. But I notice that I still do little nudge things to them. Like, oh, you know, I hate it because the stuff comes up and then I can't get rid of it until I say it. And sometimes I don't want to say it. Like my boyfriend. Hon, you know I love you. I want you to know this. Okay. In December, I came home from work, and my boyfriend packed all his stuff and left because he believed that I had been cheating. This is the first time I didn't do it. So now I'm really pissed because it's bad enough when you get caught, but it's real wrong when you didn't do it. So now I'm suffering the consequences for something I didn't even do, which is no fair. That was my line through my whole four step. Something happened in life, I got pain, no fair. And then let the games begin. So I know it's coming up. The resentment's starting to come up because this is a disease of opportunity. This disease is waiting for opportunities for it to jump in there and say, you see, this program don't work. You do the right thing. You're the right kind of person. You do your part plus. You're loving and caring, loyal, fidelity, integrity. You're all that, girl. And he still left. It don't work. And I have to hold on to the belief of, this ain't the end of the road, this is just a bend in the road. I gotta hold on to that. But these shortcomings are kicking my ass. So, him and I are like reconciling. We're still not together. He's still in New York. But while he's in New York, he winds up with some health problems. And gets diagnosed with some things that have really, like, you know, kind of knocked him off his feet. And I can see he's in pain. But there's something in me that's still in pain, too. And there's something inside me that says, see, that's what happens to people that cause people pain. That's karma. I'll call it something spiritual. Karma. Right? I'm talking about the defect of character, envy. I'm talking about finding pleasure in other people's pain because they caused me pain. And saying that's what you get. God don't like ugly. But that's not enough because, like I said before, resentments don't ever let go, so that does not ease the pain. Because it's not enough. It's never enough. So, as I'm talking to him on the phone, I know he's Hispanic. And so, because I have this information, the disease goes in search of information. Right? And just like it'll use the literature against you. You know that, right? It's like, yeah. It'll use slogans against you, too. It's like those moments whenever somebody tells me something and I really don't want to hear it, and I say, thanks for sharing. Yeah. Or when somebody is, like, doing something and I'm very judgmental of them, right? I'm calling myself spiritual, but I'm judgmental. And I say to them, yeah, just keep coming back. That's not spiritual, you know that. It's not spiritual. That's the disease using the slogans. So I know he's Hispanic, and the disease jumps on me and says, oh, you know, to some degree, Hispanics have a little bit of a belief about whenever they get illnesses, they believe it's a punishment from God. Oh, I'm on the phone with him and he's struggling with trying to take care of himself, working with diabetes. And I said to him, no compassion, no sympathy, no like concern. I say to him, well, you know, your health ain't never gonna get no better till you do right by me. So now he's struggling with some kidney problems. And my response to that is, and it's going to keep getting worse until you do right by me. So now he wants to know, do I got a voodoo doll somewhere? All because I want him to take the pain back. When the fact of the matter is that I know that by doing that, I deny my own pain. So the pain that I'm feeling isn't a result of anything he did. It's a result of something I'm doing, because I'm abandoning me by not accepting that I'm in pain here. That it hurts to be left. That I don't understand why these things happen when I do the right things, because I somehow believed that if I worked this program to the best of my ability, that it would leave me in a state of nirvana. That I would be in a place where I wouldn't feel pain anymore. That every time something in life happens that pain arises, I think I'm not working a step right. Whenever it says clearly in the text that this program wasn't designed for us to live pain-free, it's designed to help us through the pain. And if we're looking for this program to do that, then we're looking for this program to do for us what we looked for the drugs to do. That this is a program designed to get us through pain. Pain is inevitable. It's the suffering that's optional. And then comes 8. And 8 is, now that the house is all cleaned up, there's these spirits flying around haunting me still. I'm awakened, but I can't still be okay in my own skin because I'm haunted by spirits of the past, of people I've harmed. So I start making a list. My mother was top of my list. I resented my mother from a very young age. This step taught me concern. The spiritual principle of concern is to show attention or interest into a person's well-being or happiness. Show attention or interest in a person's well-being or happiness. I'm writing this list to show interest and attention to help create happiness within me and relieve the burden of others in the process too. If they get the hit, great. If not, I'm getting it. My mother's on the list because she was a very cold, callous woman. She's the resentment queen. When I was little, there was no hugs. There was no I love you. There was none of that. And I could never understand why. And I remember on my A step taking time out to talk to my mother. Instead of being so caught up in me, I took time to get to know my mother. And I started talking to her about what it was like growing up. And she started to tell me how she was in a family where my grandfather drank. And you never knew when he came home what he was going to be like, who was going to get snatched up, and who was going to get beat that day. Everybody was on eggshells when the door opened because you didn't know what kind of mood he was going to be in when he walked in the room. And that whenever he was in a bad mood, they would all run. But my mother was smaller and sickly, and she couldn't run as fast as the rest. So she got snatched the most. And she never remembers anybody holding her or hugging her or telling her that they loved her. The only time she ever remembers that, she said, is when she was sick one time, my grandmother held her in a rocking chair to help break a fever. And for the first time in my life, I saw my mother as the little girl that grew up in a house full of fear and pain. And I started to really understand. That's what it talks about. These principles talk about we seek understanding rather than being understood. It was always about, but don't you know what you did to me? But don't you know, I mightn't have turned out this way if you wouldn't have been like you were to me. If you would have just loved me. It's so all about me. And this time it wasn't. It was about we. It was about me and her. And I felt the pain. And I finally hit me that my mother really, really, now I'm not just saying, she really, really did the best she could. I felt it.
I finally felt it. I felt what love she did have. I felt it in me. And then comes the ninth step, and we try to do whatever we can to make wrong right. Whatever I have to do. It's a forgiveness step. Look, the definition of forgiveness is letting go of resentment. I remember I used to think, forgive people. Remember, it was when I first got clean. If you don't like someone, pray for them. Are you crazy? I couldn't understand that concept. It wasn't to free them, it was to free me. To let go of the resentment, to let go of the pain. If I'm upset with them for hurting me, and I keep living in the hurt, then I must be really upset with me. If I relive it again and again and again. And then comes 10, and 10 is just a cleanup step, like keep it clean. I always say, like if I'm cooking on the stove and I'm cooking sauce, and sauce pops, it splatters on top of the stove. Now, if I go get a sponge and I clean that stove up right away, it comes up like that. But if I leave that shit sit there, it takes like a Brillo and a chisel and some more stuff to get that up. So it's better to properly admit and clean it up than to have to come back later and chisel it up. But see, I know this disease. I'll tell you the importance of this 10th step. Because, you know, we say this is progress, not perfection in Narcotics Anonymous. This is a program of progress, not perfection. But a lot of times that slogan is used to justify not doing nothing. You know what I mean? It's just, I'm in my process. Right? Okay? But for real, I had to do a workshop the one time, and I looked up the word progression in the dictionary. And it says, the progression is constantly improving one's skills. So that if it's progress that I'm doing, not perfection, then if I'm progressing, then I'm constantly improving my skills. Not doing the same old, same old, same old. I'm improving. But check this out. We also have a disease of progression. I used to always think that meant like we had to pick up where we left off if we used. But come to find out with 15 years clean that this disease is progressing while I'm standing here. It's not waiting for me to pick up. It's busy right here, right now. If it wasn't, I wouldn't have shortcomings. It's constantly improving its skills and finding new ways to trick me. It's cunning. It finds new ways to trick me. It shows up, you know, it shows up as a wolf in sheep's clothing. It looks like a principal, but it's really undercover defect. I remember I used to have a thing with my father where he would never say, I love you. And I would get really upset about it. And for years, I struggled with it. And every time I would say, I love you, my father would say, like, here's a 20. So he would pay me, which was my father's MO my whole life. And so I started to called it acceptance of another human being. Just accept that whenever he gives you the 20, he's saying, I love you. And just know that he loves you. His actions speak that, even if his words don't say it. So I called it acceptance, and I settled for the 20. One day I'm in the car with my little girl, and my little girl says to me, Mom, did you ever notice that Pap never says I love you when you say I love you to him? Did I notice? I got 30 years of resentments over this shit. Of course I noticed it. And she says to me, well, why do you think that is, Ma? And I really wasn't thinking. I was like, I don't know. Maybe nobody ever taught him how to say it. So about 2 weeks later, I hear her in the living room, and I hear her saying to my father, I love you, Pap. And my father doesn't say anything back. Oh, and I'm feeling it. You know what I mean? I'm feeling it. Oh, little girl, please don't do this. You're setting yourself up for disappointment. It's one of the questions on the 10th step. Am I setting myself up for disappointment? Please don't do it. I hear her again, Pap, I said I love you. Nothing from Pap. Oh, stop now. Please, don't do it anymore. And then I'm thinking, or is she trying to get paid? I'm not sure which. Because she got some stuff with her. She's trying to get paid, maybe. So, but it still goes on. One more time, I hear her say it. Rhea says it. Pap, I said I love you. And I hear Pap say back, I love you too, Rhea. I could have fell on the floor. So I'm looking in the dining room from the kitchen I'm hiding like on a corner. Looking in to the little girl, come here, come here. So I call her in the kitchen and I said to her, how the hell did you get Pap to say I love you? She says, well, I think of what you said. She was little at the time, maybe 5, 6. I think of what you said. You say nobody taught Pap. So I tell Pap, Pap, when I say I love you, you're supposed to say I love you back. Okay, Pap? Okay? Now, wait a minute. You're going to tell me for 30 years I lived with a resentment that could have been addressed that simple by just saying, okay, Dad, here we go. Now, when I say, I was like, no, it couldn't have been that easy. But it was that easy. And I started to realize that sometimes I call myself living in acceptance when I'm really selling myself short. And I'm setting myself up to have less than what I really desire because I don't have the willingness or the courage to take the risk to step out and help people. Look, if I believe I deserve to be loved in a certain way that I need to be loved, and I'm not willing to help teach the person that I so desire this love from, then it's not them that's to blame. It's me. Look, it says it in, look, everybody knows in Recovery and Relapse, it says that one paragraph, oh, relationships can be a terrible stumbling block in recovery. Everybody knows that paragraph. We say it like out loud in meetings, the whole paragraph, everybody knows it. But the very next paragraph is the solution to the problem. Nobody knows that paragraph. Isn't that a special? It's a special thing. I think I had 10 years clean before I actually read on. The next paragraph says that if we don't want to end up in this stumbling block in relationships, placing unrealistic expectations on ourselves and others, ending up feeling like resentful and bitter, wallowing in self-pity with these, like, you know what I mean, defects creeping in on us, then what we need to do is make a list of what we want, what we're asking for, and what we're getting. And we need to share this list with our sponsor or somebody else in recovery that we trust to hold us accountable to the list. It's like the same thing in 5. We expose this to somebody else, not because we need somebody else to know it, but because we need somebody to hold us accountable to it. When I say I need to come clean, just look, I remember getting arrested. The DEA arrested me, and they had a videotape of me selling dope outside I used to sell dope out the window like I was a Dairy Queen. Because, here, check this out, because I believed that if they didn't see my face, then they couldn't really arrest me. It was my house. What's that, right? My house. So I used to sell dope out the window, and they had me on videotape one day with the door open, spitting balloons in my hand, handing the balloons to somebody and taking their money. And I sat there and said, that's not me. I'm talking about denial. I'm talking about how we will deny to the bitter ends that the whole thing about the 5th step and an ongoing, like, 10th step is based on me admitting from my own lips what the deal is with me. Me saying it, if I don't say it, it is not real. I remember I used to say that. Who said? Who said? I didn't say that. Wasn't me. Until I say it, it's not real. And until it's real, I will not deal with it. I will live in an illusion that I'm somebody other than who I really am, and I'm living a life other than what I'm living. The 11th step has been such a blessing for me. Like I said, I had recently gone to school for this nursing thing, and I really didn't know if I could do it, and I'm still struggling with it because I had felony convictions, and I didn't think that, I didn't know if I could live beyond the wreckage of my past. But when I was a little girl, look, up there, like when I was a little girl, I had a dream. I had a dream of being either a nurse or a teacher. Somehow or another, in the mix of the grip, I got hopeless and lost those dreams. Now here I am on my 11th step, and these dreams are starting to awaken again. These lost dreams are awakening because new possibilities are arising. I go to a function, I'm taking a newcomer to a function, and I see an old sponsee there. And I say to this sponsee, what have you been doing? And she tells me she's in nursing school. And I say, you got felony convictions. How could you be in nursing school? She says, if they're more than 10 years old, they'll let you in. Well, I actually been clean long enough to actually be off parole. That's unbelievable. I haven't been off of paper since 1976. In 2000, I finally was off paper. So I'm like, clear. She says, as a matter of fact, if you get the forms and you fill them out, there's another sponsee of yours' husband that's actually filing for a pardon from his I'm like, well, shoot, pardon me too. I want a pardon too. And I'm thinking, was it possible, God, that I can, like, so I call up the school and I ask the school, well, like, you know, can I get into this nursing program with these felony convictions? And they're like, well, do the prerequisites, which is a lot of work, and we'll let you know. So I figured, well, let me just ask the state, if I do this whole program, will they let me get a license? So I email the state, and the state emails me back, well, do the program, and we'll let you know. So I'm like, wait a minute. This is like, do the work and we'll let you know later thing? So this, for the past like year and a half, I've been like knocking on doors on blind faith, and they've been opening up and I've been walking through them. And when I first finished my prerequisites and started the nursing program, I got a certificate in the mail, opened it up, and I made the dean's list. And I said to myself, what a blessing this is from Narcotics Anonymous. I went from the first step, being on the DEA list, hey, all the way to the 11th step, being on the dean's list. All as a result of Narcotics Anonymous. Because you believed in me, and I started to believe in me too. It's a result of my 11th step. And the 12th step is just like an open house. I just like share my experiences to let other people know, like, that whatever it is that you're going through, you can get through it. Whatever you believe, right? If you come to believe what we believe, you'll find hope. That there's a way out of the grip of active addiction. There's a new way of life. You really, really don't have to live like that anymore. Really. And I just especially want to thank my sponsees, and I love you guys so much, because I'm struggling this past year. Being working full-time, going to school full-time, having the kids to take care of, elderly parents, I'm an only child. It's been rough, and my meetings have dwindled. I got 15 years clean. I usually always made 4 meetings a week. I'm down to 1 and 2. But my sponsees do not fail me. I know why sponsorship's a two-way street, because they keep doing their step work. And when they keep doing their step work, I have to go over their step work with them. And when I go over their step work with them, it keeps me in touch with the steps, so that no matter what's going on or how busy it gets, they keep me plugged in. They keep me close to recovery. And I just want to tell them I love them for believing in recovery and doing the work, because you're saving my ass right now. So I just want to thank everyone for being here. Have a safe journey home. And I just want to close with a poem that someone shared with me when I first came into recovery. And it's about why we were chosen as addicts, why God chose addicts to help addicts. Not like individually why we were chosen, but just addicts as a group, why we were chosen as a group to help each other. It says, "Until your weak and feeble hands, I have entrusted a power beyond estimate. To you has been given that which has been denied your most learned of fellows. Not to scientists or statesmen, not to wives or mothers, not even to priests or ministers, have I given this gift of healing other addicts which I entrust to you. It must be used unselfishly. It carries with it grave responsibility. No day can be too long, no effort too great, no task too difficult, no case too pitiful. It must be used with tolerance because I restrict its application to no race, no creed, and no denomination. You've been chosen because you were the outcast of the world, and your long experience as addicts has made you humbly alert to the desperate cries that come from the lonely hearts of addicts everywhere. So let's carry this message and keep recovery available to us all. Thanks for letting me share."